Hi, I'm Yaakov Katz, and welcome to another episode of the Jewish People Policy Institute's Inside Analysis of the State of Affairs of Israel and the Jewish World. On today's episode, we have an interview with Dr. Jonathan Shanzer, who is the Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he oversees the work of the organization's experts and scholars. And Jonathan is also the author of two very interesting books about Hamas and the Gaza Strip, one that was written shortly after Hamas took over Gaza from Fatah back in the summer of 2007, and another one more recently after Israel's Operation Guardian of the Walls in May of 2021, where he looked at that operation and analyzed to see what were the mistakes, the successes. So there's a lot to talk with Jonathan about in kind of understanding and analyzing the ongoing ground offensive and war that Israel is still engaged in over 135, 136 days now since the massacre of October 7th. We're also going to be joined by two fellows from JPPI, our Senior Vice President, Professor Shuki Friedman, as well as Dr. Sarah Hirshhorn, one of our new hires at JPPI, who we already had on once, and now we're privileged to have again. So first, we'll have the interview with Jonathan Shanzer, and then we will go to Sarah and Shuki. Jonathan, it's great to have you with the JPPI webinar podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Yaakov.
So, you know, you've been writing about this for a long time, and you were just showing me again the two books about Hamas in particular, but one about the takeover by Hamas of Gaza back in 2007, the operation that Israel launched against Hamas, or was actually forced upon us, depends how you look at things, back in 2021. I'm curious to get your take. You know, we're 100 now and 35, 36 days into the war. And is victory possible, from your opinion?
Well, okay, we need to unpack this, obviously, because victory could mean different things. I would argue that, first of all, Israel has performed really remarkably on the battlefield since October 7th. Obviously, October 7th itself was a failure. The IDF did not adequately respond to the Hamas attack on that day. But in the subsequent days since, we have seen Israel get off its back, get onto its knees, and then finally get up and fight in ways that I think surprised even the IDF, that surprised even the Israeli public. I think there was probably some concern about the way in which reservists would fight. And the reservists have fought admirably, I mean, beyond admirably. When you look at, you know, the fact that these people were slinging falafel 4 months ago, and now they're, you know, humping 40-pound bags across the deserts of Gaza, and they are, they're winning. I mean, right. You know, they've killed 10,000 Hamas fighters. They've arrested something like 2,500. They've injured another 10,000. There's something like 7,500 fighters left. And, you know, they're all, from what we can tell, holed up underground in the tunnel system, or they're getting ready to try to beat back a maneuver in the town of Rafah. And so, you know, I mean, I think the Israelis have done great. Now, the question is, can they keep Hamas defeated? And I think the answer there is probably not, but Hamas will not exist as a fully functioning paramilitary any longer. They are going to likely operate in the future as a shadowy terrorist organization without a headquarters, without a safe haven. And that really is, in my view, the big achievement here for Israel. You know, will there be a Hamas that continues to operate out of Algeria or Turkey or Qatar or Lebanon? Of course there will be. And there will always be people that are going to try to destroy Israel in the name of Palestinian nationalism or in the name of Islam, or perhaps a combination of both as we look at Hamas. But it will revert, in my view, to a tactical threat so long as Israel can sustain the victories that it has achieved so far on the ground in Gaza.
So there are two things that would need to happen for those victories to be sustained. One is for continuous Israeli military operations to an extent, or overall umbrella security control over Gaza going in and out, maybe similar to what we see today in the West Bank. And two is the mechanism that will replace or will come into Gaza in what we call the day after scenario of this war. So my question here is, number one, are you confident that Israel is going to do that? I hope they will. And I, by the way, when people ask me about the victory, I say doing that is the victory. That change in the security reality is itself the victory. But I hope that it's possible. So I'm asking you whether you're confident. On the second part, you're sitting in the Washington, D.C. area. You're working in D.C. You're talking to a lot of American officials. There is frustration with the fact that Israel is not presenting publicly what its day after scenario looks like, except for saying, and how does the prime minister say it in Hebrew? It's called Nitzachon Mochetz, right? A complete victory. Okay, that's a nice idea, and we all love it, and we all want it, but what does that actually mean? So how do you work through those two issues?
Okay, so let's take first the day after, because I've been doing a lot of thinking about this. I was in Israel about a month and a half ago, and I got some briefings on possible day after scenarios and the kinds of plans that Israel would like to implement with the United States, with the Saudis, with the Emiratis, with the Europeans. There are all kinds of really good ideas. But let me just say this. The idea of a day after scenario is, I think, a uniquely American phenomenon, that we push our military and we push our political leaders to articulate a vision for how everything is going to be great. And then we start building toward how great that's going to be, right? And we invest tens of hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in the political and civilian infrastructure that's needed for the day after scenario. And then guess what? The enemy starts to destroy those things because they know exactly what it is that we're trying to build and they want to destroy it, right? It is part of the military objectives that we've already articulated and they want to destroy them. So there is, I think, an open question about how much needs to be revealed now while the fighting is still intense. Now, you could maybe make the argument that you need to wait until the major fighting is done. So let's say in another month or 2 months, the operation in Rafah is over. There is what the Israelis are now describing as, cleanup that would come after the major fighting. Then I think you could start to build and articulate. But I do question whether our saying all these things now out loud only serves to strengthen the hand of the enemy. And I do think that there needs to be some additional deliberation here. I do think that the U.S. is a bit naive in the way that we've approached this in the past, and that we're trying to force the Israelis to do what we've done, which has not been successful. It truly hasn't. So, I think that that's for the day after. But now, as for the Israeli articulation of a complete or total victory, I think that's where the Israelis are on a slippery slope, because, we will, as I already mentioned, you're going to see Hamas continue to exist in places like Algeria. That's probably going to be the next stronghold of the organization. The Turks are probably not going to stop housing Hamas. The Qataris may or may not, depending on who you talk to. But this group's going to be active. It's going to have funding from the Iranians. It's going to have assistance from Hezbollah. It's going to have, financial and political cover from a range of Islamist countries around the world. The question is, can the Israelis contain the attempted resurgence of Hamas in ways that will keep it looking like a ragtag force and one that is beat up and limping and bleeding, as opposed to something that looks like it's able to carry out attacks worldwide? That's, I think, the real question. And actually, I'll just say this, that the key to this may not be Gaza, right? If the Israelis succeed in flushing Hamas out of Gaza, then Hamas becomes an international problem. And then, in that case, it will be actually a challenge for the Mossad to take out the leadership in each of these jurisdictions that I've mentioned and to keep the group off balance. I believe we are likely going to see a campaign not unlike what we saw after the 72 Olympics, the Munich attacks, right, where the Mossad went out.
Wrath of God, I think, was the operation name.
Correct. And the idea that, you know, the Mossad would just one after another knock out these leaders, inspire fear in the leadership, drive them underground. That's what I think that secondary victory looks like after Hamas is largely cleared out of Gaza.
Let's hope that's right. I was flipping through Hamas vs. Fatah, your book from 2008, which came out just about a year after Hamas took over the Gaza Strip violently in the summer of 2007 from Fatah. And you write a lot about there about Palestinian political unity and what are the chances and the different ideologies of Hamas and of Fatah. But also, you know, to some extent, looking back at it now, and this was obviously written, you know, 15, 16 years ago now, is, I don't want to say the writing was on the wall, right? This is kind of pre-Operation Cast Lead, which was the big operation of 08, 09, but everything was building up towards this clash and explosion. And you kind of like hint along the way, or not hint, but you say, I mean, there's something coming, right? Winds of war and it's all out there. It's obvious. I mean, this is an organization that bent on Israel's destruction. There's no kind of secret here. Now, you think of all that and all what you've studied and researched and written. And then I put you into October 6th and October 7th. Where do you think we went wrong here? In when you look at, now obviously there's a lot of, you know, I'm not expecting you, Jonathan, to tell me, okay, what happened on the night between the 6th and the 7th, the phone call, what did we know, what did we not know? That's on the very tactical level at that stage. But if you go up to 30,000 feet, as someone who's really studied these issues, who knows Israel well, where do you think that our biggest mistake was?
So I can get to the strategic and I can get to the tactical. And I don't purport to have all the answers, but let me just say this first. The idea of leaving a terrorist group in a safe haven is a recipe for disaster. We saw it here in the U.S. when we decided to leave the Taliban in place and they allowed al-Qaeda to operate in that safe haven. And then we paid a terrible price for it on 9/11 and then subsequently for years after fighting, you know, a war on terror. That's a safe haven problem, right? And by the way, Israel has more than one safe haven problems right now, right? They've got Hamas, which they're dealing with. And then on top of that, there's Hezbollah. They're another group that has a safe haven, which means that all the entire time they've been allowed to operate in these places, they're developing new capabilities. They're stockpiling weapons. They're training. They're planning. They're thinking about Israel's demise and they're working toward it. And every day that you allow them that time and space is another day that they get stronger and more capable of achieving their objectives. And that is a huge problem. And I would say that was the big problem. And you could see the writing on the wall. Now, there was maybe two other things that I think are worth mentioning. One is that Israel treated Hamas as a tactical threat. And look, you could make the argument that it's weaker than Hezbollah, it's weaker than the regime itself, it's maybe even, you know, maybe the group has fewer capabilities than even the Houthis when you think about it. Fine, but this is still a group that has, as we now know, right, it had, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in assistance. It had 30,000 fighters that were being trained both in Gaza and outside of Gaza. They had naval capabilities different kinds of rockets and missiles, including some precision technology that they were working on. I mean, and there was an organization, a full structure that came with it, and a whole army of apologists in the West, right? So, you know, and every time Israel battled with Hamas, the price grew in terms of the public relations stuff that was going on in the international media, the human shields problems that Israel was dealing with every time Hamas fired next to a hospital or an UNRWA facility or a school, the headaches grew. And so there was just, I think, you know, in my view, it was inevitable that we were going to reach a place along the lines of what we see now. Could I have predicted 10-7? No, I didn't have the imagination for it. And neither did the Israelis. And the Israelis will say openly that it wasn't a question of intelligence because they had the little snippets here and there, but that they didn't imagine that Hamas could pull off a slaughter, a pogrom along the lines of what we saw. But the last thing I'll just say is I actually had a conversation with a senior Israeli official about 2 weeks before the 10-7 attack. And I talked to this individual about the West Bank primarily because Congress here was interested in the pay for slay issue and the ways in which the PA had been financing terrorism or terrorist supporters, families of terrorists, et cetera, over the years. But at the end of the conversation, I asked my interlocutor, I said, what's going on in Gaza? And here I'll just tell you, I heard the intelligence failure. I literally heard it. This person told me that that they believed that Hamas was contained, that Yahya Sinwar was becoming more pragmatic, that he was no longer interested in inviting disastrous wars upon Gaza, and that he was trying to give the population of, you know, 2.2 million people more opportunities, more products, more services, and the Israelis were content to try to work with him, according to what I heard. And this was, I think, drinking their own Kool-Aid. In other words, Israel would love to have quiet. Of course Israel would, right? I'm sure you would, Yaakov. I mean, everybody would like all of this to go away. And so when you hear somebody tell you that they're willing to allow for, you know, some semblance of peace or quiet, you're going to believe it, or you want to believe it. And that is where the danger is for Israel, unfortunately. You know, I think that there will be moments of calm, as we've seen for maybe the last 10, 20 years, and there'll be moments of war, as we're watching now. But I don't know if there will ever be full peace in the way that Israel would like to see, or full quiet. It's going to be trust but verify for decades, maybe centuries for Israel. And that's, of course, not great news, but, you know, you live in the Middle East, different rules over there.
Well said. Jonathan Shanzer from the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
So, Sarah and Shuki, very interesting interview with Jonathan, but I want to switch gears for a moment and talk about the policies that we're seeing coming out, particularly of the United States, but also now the UK and France. And I'm talking specifically about the sanctioning or the imposition of sanctions on Israeli, what I guess for the lack of a better term, settlers or residents of the West Bank, of Judea and Samaria, people who these countries suspect of being involved in what they call settler violence. And I do want to talk in a bit about what this phenomenon settler violence is and whether it might be being blown a bit out of proportion. I tend to think that it is. But Shuki, before we do that, I mean, this is serious stuff. And I know that you, in addition to your work at the think tank and what you do as a writer and an analyst, but you also spent some years in government and you were actually involved as head of the Iran Sanctions Committee in Israel. So you've worked with OFAC, which is the American government branch that's responsible essentially for all sanctions against individuals around the world. They are too involved in this one as well. I mean, give us kind of how serious is this situation?
I think it's the most crucial and dramatic turning point in the history of the settlements in recent years, and I will explain. For decades, Israel is building settlements, and for decades, 3 decades already, the BDS movement trying to sanction this activity, sanction Israel, but specifically sanction the activity in West Bank. And for 3 decades, they're basically failing in doing it efficiently. I mean, here and there, they got successes, they blocked some activities, some EU corporations wouldn't work in the West Bank and so forth. But basically, the majority of the world does not see the activity in the West Bank as illegitimate. And what Biden's executive order has done is actually to refrain from legal and political perspective all activities in West Bank. Why? Because, you know, when you read the headline newspapers and you hear the news, you might think that it's marginal because, you know, 4 extremist senators and someone in the West Bank being sanctioned and their bank accounts being frozen and so forth. But the truth is that the way the order is working is to frame what is a potentially illegitimate activity in the West Bank, and then a decision to sanction particular entities or individuals based on these activities. Now, the order is saying something very vague and wide about what's potentially been done by more sanctions. It says that any activity that might breach the stability of the region or disturb the ability of the state to promote the two-state solution might be sanctioned. And that means, for example, that if tomorrow morning the Israeli government decide through a legal procedure here in Israel, legitimately, to build another neighborhood to a settlement called Eli in Samaria. And the administration, basically the president or Secretary of State, decide this activity might block the ability of the administration to promote a two-state solution, it can sanction it. Everything and everybody.
And it can sanction, I mean, just to be clear, Shuki, everything. So it could sanction the people involved, the construction company, everything.
The financial institution supporting it. And this is dramatic. Now, basically, it said to Israel and to settlers, watch out. If you go down this road, not only being, of course, violence and sanction of Palestinians, all in Israel, but defining a sanction activity like something that disturbs the U.S. policies in the region is so vague and general that they can use it to anyone.
So, Sarah, you've written about settlers, particularly American-born and bred settlers who moved to Israel and helped found some of these settlements. I mean, you know, first of all, there's an interesting question of just how really profound and widespread is this phenomenon that's called settler violence that, you know, the Americans seem to want to try to make some sort of, my issue is the moral equivalency, it seems that they're trying to create between settler violence and Hamas. But really, I think it also has to do with domestic policies and politics that Joe Biden is facing in places in the U.S. where he's losing some of his progressive flank and others. But obviously, as Shuki points out, the executive order that gave them the right to impose these sanctions is very broad and can be widespread. How do you view where is this coming from? I mean, why suddenly now are the Americans doing this?
I think the Biden administration is really struggling with the current government, particularly the participation of the ultra-nationalist ministers within this government, even if they've been excluded officially from the war cabinet, and is trying to seek change from outside in a way that they have not been able to convince Benjamin Netanyahu or his colleagues to conform to U.S. doctrine by diplomatic means. But as Professor Friedman just suggested, the test of this executive order is so wide that it could almost define anything as violence. Building another apartment block could be considered violence. Installing cable television in a new neighborhood of a settlement could be considered violence. So I think that is problematic from the viewpoint of ensuring a two-state solution to understand what is, been within the Oslo blueprint and what, really goes beyond it. Now, obviously, Israel has had its own problems in deterring settler terrorism. The will of this government to do so has been incredibly weak, and I think only about 2% of settler terrorist incidents are actually prosecuted in Israeli courts. And the Biden administration is clearly upset about this and the implications for instability in the region, particularly, we could see this might happen only in the next few months if this, if Itamar Ben-Gvir's plans go forth with the Temple Mount, blocking access to Temple Mount to Ram al-Sharif or Ramadan to Muslim populations. You could see uprisings in the West Bank and clashes between settlers and Palestinians emerge once again. And I think that the Biden administration is very concerned about these kinds of incidents. But its imposition from the outside, is a stick that an administration can wield, but it seems like a very blunt instrument and one that may indeed, I think, create a kind of equivalency, as you have suggested, that is inaccurate and I think morally bankrupt in many ways, but also can backfire entirely.
But, Shuki, I'm curious because Israel has a rule of law, right? We have a judicial system. Now, I mean, Sarah pointed out the American complaint is that we're not prosecuting or investigating enough of these cases, and therefore they feel the need and the urgency for them to do these things with the sanctions. Actually, one of the people of the four that the American sanctions is currently in administrative detention here in Israel, right? Which is a very, I would say, draconian legal tool that we use against people to put them into jail when not without being able to prove or bring the evidence to court. It's mostly used for Palestinian terror suspects, but also occasionally for so-called settler perpetrators of settler violence. So on the one hand, we have a rule of law. So it's very different than sanctions that America would impose on countries that don't have a rule of law. Number one. Number two, is it really the settler violence that's bothering the Biden administration, or is it something else? Is it the fact that they're frustrated with our government for not promoting a day after scenario, some sort, not getting on board with the love boat or the peace train or whatever you want to call it with the two-state solution, is maybe, and therefore what Biden's doing is kind of the least of what he could do, because he could stop weapons and he could do a lot more, but he's got to do something, and this is what he's doing.
Yeah, it's a mixture of motivations, both internal and external. I mean, internal policies within the U.S. in the election year and external. And start with internal. I mean, Biden's in some battleground states fighting for voters from the Muslim community, mainly Michigan and other places as well. And you can recall that he declared the executive order just before he attended to rally in Michigan, where right. The huge Muslim community that started to reconsider supporting him because he's supporting Israel. So you have to pay in any way to try to recruit these voters and to calm them down, because we all know he supported Israel dramatically through the war and still. So this is internally, but externally, of course, from the very beginning of this Israeli government, the administration is dramatically frustrated from the nomination of the ministers. And furthermore, the two ministers that are in charge on enforcement in the West Bank and policies in West Bank are Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. Smotrich is deputy minister of defense in charge of the West Bank, and Ben-Gvir is in charge of enforcement of the
I totally forgot.
I mean, he's the far right possible. So
no, I had forgotten that Smotrich also has that portfolio of the defense ministry. Yeah.
Right. So basically, you know, Netanyahu decided to actually not take in any consideration the sensitivities in DC. And now he's paying for it. And we are perfect. Now I have to, in my perspective, the actual violence of settlers in the West Bank is marginal. Taking the 500,000 Israelis living there, maybe 100 people, and I'm exaggerating, are in any way involved in it. But there is a lack of enforcement, and also a campaign that successfully echoed this violence or events of well-filmed hitting and expelling of Palestinians in some regions, and successfully managed to put a narrative of settlers' violence against Palestinians, a wide phenomena in the media and to the administration. And the result of all this is a president of an executive order that you would never expect from a so close ally.
You know, Sarah, so in the research that you've done, especially for your book that's about the settlers, the American ones who moved to, and how, but it's something on a hilltop, right? The my question is, you know, what is it about the West Bank or Judea and Samaria and the settlements that really causes for this anarchy to some extent, this lawlessness, right? This isn't the first time. This has been something that's been going on for decades.
Yeah, and I think that the Biden administration in that way is also identifying a kind of low-hanging fruit, going back to the previous question of, you know, an issue to tackle within Israeli politics and society that, you know, has been an historic grievance and also is, you know, something that is on the international agenda, as opposed to many other issues within, you know, both territorial Israel and the occupied territories that are worthy of, you know, discussion and policy propositions. But, you know, the West Bank is a place that suffers from a split governance where Israeli citizens have a different set of rights than Palestinians under the occupation. And I think this obviously creates a sense of different rules for different people. But settlers themselves, for the most part, as Professor Friedman said, are law-abiding citizens. It just depends on whether you believe that you know, settlements are against international law or not. The vast majority of them you know, are living and going to work and, you know, going about their daily lives like most other citizens within territorial Israel. But there is a percentage who feel that their mission to live in the whole of the land of Israel includes harassing and expelling the Palestinian population who lives there, and making it a hostile climate for any kind of peace agreement to go forward, including one that could be encouraged or even imposed from the outside, like by the United States. So there is a sense that lawlessness, and a lawlessness that can be traced back to the original origins of the Israeli settler movement, which of course was a movement that was tacitly supported by the labor government in the 1970s, but was also really a wildcat enterprise by activist organizations and individuals that goes back to the beginnings of the project and has, you know, remained part and parcel of what the project is and needs to promote as part of its own credibility to its own community ever since.
And let's also just be clear, Sarah, that the support for cracking down on settlements is quite widespread, definitely within the Democratic Party and among President Biden's voters. So it's not as if he's going against his base of support, right?
Absolutely. And I think that given the fact that, you know, the Biden administration is not necessarily willing to change its policy on the current Hamas-Israel war, which many of many left-wing flank of the Democratic Party consider to be a genocide, the Biden administration doesn't have that many policy tools it can exercise. And again, this is a really low-hanging fruit here, I think, that there is consensus about.
Right. Shuki, I want to ask you before we wrap up, you know, the one of the ramifications, and you mentioned this before, is because of the sanctions that have been imposed by America, by the Brits, by the British, and now also by the French, Israeli banks are freezing the bank accounts of these Israeli citizens. And the numbers are already getting into several dozen, right? The Americans were four people. The British, I think, were maybe seven or eight. And now the French is 20 plus. So the numbers are increasing. And if the doomsday scenario, Shuki, that you pointed out before actually materializes, where, you know, the Ailey scenario, as you called it, where we could have heads of regional councils or politicians or construction companies or just random people who were just living in the West Bank are now getting sanctioned. How can people live in this country without bank accounts? What is Israel going to do as a government and as a country?
First of all, the doomsday is already here in a way, because after the administration published this order, FinCEN, the branch is responsible for enforcement on financial institutions, take published a warning to financial institutions to be aware of the potential risk of transfers to the West Bank, which means that the compliance officers of financial institutions worldwide would tell to their banks, watch out, every transfer that coming in any way from entity, individual, or something coming from the West Bank, watch out and block it, and then see. So it might, in a way, disrupt financial activity already from just putting this frame and sanctioning a few people. Now, down the road, it's really a huge challenge, because if you blocked by sanctions from working with bank accounts anywhere, you practically can't work. You can't manage your life, your daily life. And therefore, what Israel should do, mainly Prime Minister Netanyahu, I think, is to try, first of all, to understand what Americans are telling him and respond and try to cancel this executive order, which put a constant threat down the road, if it will be still there, to any decision Israeli government will take. And more, furthermore, any decisions officials which in charge of enforcement in the West Bank taking, because there are eligible sanctions by the order as well. So basically, it's a turning point and a strategic threat on the future of the settlements. And I think the leadership of the settlers, the right-wing leaders and the government should be more aware and sensitive to the crucial need of any kind of legitimacy to living in the West Bank.
Thank you for joining us today. You can find all our episodes where you get your podcasts. Please share widely and give us a 5-star review. We will see you back here soon.